it was all a pipe dream, watching bodyboarding up on TV. Deep at reef, watching tension repeats, eating bakery feeds at 18, living the dream with no sunscreen. Yeah, we were so keen, surfing Aussie pipe, buying Riptide, eating
G'day and welcome to the Riptide Bodyboarding Podcast, the home of bodyboarding. Thank you for joining us on episode 91 of our verbal journaling, and I'm your host, Luke O'Connor. Well, today's guest has been a guest on the podcast previously. He's a good friend. He's a cinematographer. He's a man who's making quite a splash in the boog industry of late in regards to his newest and upcoming project, Common Thread Film, which we are going to heavily talk about today and dissect a lot of different parts of this cool and creative cat's mind. I'm talking to none other than Adrian Emmerdon. Thanks for coming on, Adrian.
Mate, thanks for having me.
No drums at all, bruh. No
drums. What's more narcissistic than setting up your own podcast interview with your own gear? I don't know. It has to be the way I start this, eh? It's like, I elevate the production level on the thing that I'm actually on, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm just calling myself out straight away, you know, just for the haters out there.
Yeah, but, you know, you talk the talk and you walk the walk with this sort of stuff. You've rocked up before, like even... You know, going straight to the urban surf wave pool party, you know, like and having our night out there. Like the way you rocked up with all the gear there, man, it was just pretty mind blowing, hey. And such a professionally like put together setup. Has that like taken, you know, years of you honing your gear and honing the experience, you know, with all different aspects of your filming to kind of get to that point?
Yeah, it's just being like pretty obsessive about it, I guess. For me, bodyboarding was the thing that kind of pushed me into pursuing film as a career. And now it's the thing that, like, I can sort of apply the stuff I learned through my commercial and career stuff back into the booging. So it's nice to be able to sort of to do that and bring it back into the sport and just have heaps of fun doing it. Like, I love doing it.
No, I mean, you can really tell. Let's get the fundamentals down, Pat, because... Not many people would know your background and where you've come from in regards to your professional career and intertwined with bodyboarding. And, you know, now, as I mentioned in the intro, making probably one of the most exciting and progressive kind of bodyboarding films the industry seen in a long time. Where did the humble beginning start? What was the journey for Adrian Emmerdon in a creative sense? As you still adjust the parameters in which we've been creative.
There's a lot going on, eh? it started like, man, when I was a kid, I really looked up to guys like the Waldron brothers, who I was mates with growing up in the Central Coast.
Yep.
And they obviously did their thing with, they were like the most successful sports podcast when it became a thing.
The Boom podcast?
The Boom one, yeah. It literally did top the ranks of most successful at the time.
That's wild.
Just fucking wild.
So that would have been like 12, 13 years ago?
Aid, man, way before then.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, for sure. Like, wow. You think about it, it would have been mid-2000s. Like, it would have been, wow. Like, yeah, 2000 and, I reckon, 2006 or something.
So we're
like
looking
that,
at 17, 18 years?
Yeah, a long time.
It's pretty solid.
Crazy, yeah.
And considering where the podcast medium is now and, like, you know, what it has become. But back then, the traction wouldn't have been there the same way.
Yeah, like those guys, like seeing them... Like when I was growing up on the coast, I was like, fuck, they're like, looks like they're having a lot of fun. Like, I want to do what these guys are doing at some point, but I didn't really know what that meant. I kind of thought to myself, oh, I want to maybe I want to make, you know, a bodyboarding film one day, you know. And I had this idea back when I was in my mid teens, like 14, 15 years old. And then that little idea in the back of my thought just kept like chipping away at me. And, I did design at uni and I'm a shithouse designer. Like, I have no mechanical aptitude. I've learned a little bit since then, but like, I was so bad at designing things. I designed things that were like twice the size they were meant to be and fucking upside down, you know, and somehow I got a degree. But then I was like, oh, I've got to get some kind of work in production, which is the thing that I knew in the back of my mind I wanted to get into. So I had a mate that was working for a pretty well-known TV commercial director at the time. And he hit me up and he said, look, my mate, well, this guy I'm working for, Rob, he's looking for a new assistant. I'm moving on from working with him. You should come down to Sydney and meet him. So I was like, oh, yeah, cool. So this was around the time that I pretty much had just finished uni. I was working in a pub in Newcastle. I was just surfing and partying and just being distracted, young 20-something-year-old. And I ended up going down to meet this director, who turns out to be a pretty well-known like TV commercial director. And he picked me up in his boat and he drove me across to his island he lived on.
Whoa.
Yeah. And this is in on Northern Beaches, like over Macarthur Creek Way.
Yeah.
Up near where Wally's from, actually.
Yeah,
like
yeah. The top echelon.
Yeah.
Where Steve Ball's from.
A lot of interesting people up there, right? Yeah. There's something in the water up there. I don't know what it is.
Freshy.
Yeah. what do you call that? The mix between salt and fresh water.
Yeah.
Fuck, how do we not know that
word? I know. It's a special blend, though. Yeah. Well, don't they reckon that is a special blend because in certain areas it creates like such an abundance of life?
Yeah. Oh, true. That's a really good analogy. Yeah.
That's why I was getting back to the wall. Yeah. Like, here's an abundance of life.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Mm, everyone should take a leaf out of his book.
Hats off to him, mate.
Shit that he does is unbelievable.
For sure.
Leaves no stone unturned.
For sure. So I met this dude and he was, I was like, fuck, he's, you know, he had like all these accolades, all these awards and stuff in his home. And he was like, oh, yeah, well, like talking about all these big jobs he was shooting. And anyway, had lunch with him and then it went well. He dropped me back to the mainland and off I drove back to Newcastle. And I got a call in the pub the next day and knew where I was working saying, hey, it's Rob. Look, I thought we got along quite well. I'm going to China to shoot the major car commercial for the Beijing Olympics. Can you meet me at the airport tonight? And then I'll meet you in China in 2 days. Like a producer will sort out your visa and stuff.
Wow.
And I was like, fuck, this is a pretty exciting time. Like,
let's go.
Yeah. So I moved out of my house.
And you're up in Newcastle all the time? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What part of Newey?
I was living in Merriweather at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was working in a pub called Mary Ellen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Merriweather's a pretty sick little like slice of Newcastle, eh?
Oh, it's sick. Yeah. It's so good. And like all those waves around there, like I was surfing, you know, all the waves around Nobby's and whatnot. And I didn't actually venture further south at that time to some other undisclosed locations. But now that I know they're there, I'm like fucking kicking myself. Look at those spots.
Did you ever see the big grizzly bear around?
Oh, he was around. Yeah.
In hibernation sometimes, coming out and like snatching salmon from the harbour.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. But so like knew it was a good time. But yeah, I just spent a lot of my time just kind of just drifting a bit, like having a good time through uni, but not really sure what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then got.
And how old were you at this stage?
I was like 23 at the time.
Yeah. Well, man.
So still so young. Yeah. Like you think about how young that is now. Like now I'm 41, which is scary. But
you sort of didn't know what you want to do either.
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's it. You're just kind of figuring it out. You're just doing things, eh? But so anyway, like, yeah. So this guy's like, yeah, meet me in China in 2 days. So like moved up my stuff out of my house. Met with Dad on the freeway in the Central Coast, unloaded all the gear, kept going down to the airport, met up with this dude. He's like, oh, sweet. Producer's going to sort out your visa. I jumped on a plane like 24 hours after that.
Sick.
And all of a sudden I'm thrown into this like high-end production world where I was like literally a living assistant to this dude who was like, he was a middle-aged gay man as well. So it was like one of those things where I was like, I was learning a lot about people.
For sure.
I'd never spent time with someone like that before.
And was he quite flamboyant?
He wasn't, though, because he'd only like come out a couple of years before then. Okay, so it was still quite reserved, but I was almost acting as his like friend and psychologist because he had like all these issues he was having to work through all the time and I was just always there, you know, and he wanted friendship, man. He wanted someone around, but also to help him on the shoot. So I was like, he'd definitely give me the shits at times because I knew that he'd like part of the job was just to be kind of around, you know?
Yeah.
But then the other half is incredible because I get to like travel the world and like go on these amazing shoots and like learn from the best pretty much.
For sure. So you guys had the good with the bad there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Was it kind of like a Devil's Wear Prada scenario? Like, have you seen that movie?
Oh, fuck. I can't remember it.
But more so, did you have some really hectic, you know, tasks put upon you and like there were some unfair moments where you had to just grit your teeth and get on with it?
Yeah. Oh, there were just a few moments where like our personalities definitely clashed a bit because he had other guys that worked for him who were a similar age and surprise, surprise, the same kind of stereotype dude, surfer kid from the coast. It's like Harvey Weinstein moment maybe, you know, but like they were literally, like, all jokes aside, they were like kind of fitting a certain demographic, but like I've never been one to kind of hold back from speaking my mind.
Yeah, for sure.
If it reaches a certain point,
yeah.
Like I can be, you know, I can tread carefully and navigate, you know, a situation. But like, if someone's really being a dickhead, I'll call it out.
Yeah, and I think that's a really valuable trait to have, man, because like, you can be a pacifist and you can cruise on in life, and you know, and there's also a really good, you know, on the flip side, to have like an emergency switch, like a stop off, to not go to that next level and lose your temper, because I've definitely done that multiple times. It never really ends well. But to be that middle ground of like speaking your mind when, you know it's so important, and then to not let moments slip by that you can't ever regain, or kind of put that person in their place, so to speak. Like, there's something very powerful about that. It can get you a lot of place in life. It can get definitely closed doors for you, but it can open a lot of doors too.
Well, upon reflection, after my 45th girlfriend today, it has its pros and cons, you know.
But if something's not right, something's not right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I just think it's valuable, kind of like getting to the truth of things, you know, like who knows what the actual truth of things are a lot of the time, but like if you can get close to it, it's going to make for like a more interesting journey and experience, and like a more honest sort of relationship with people as well.
So. 100%. And they respect you more in the end. At the time, you can ruffle feathers, but they'll respect you more in the end because you actually said it how it is. So many motherfuckers in the world today just go on by playing the political correct game and don't ever put their foot in it when they know it is correct. It's a powerful trait to have.
I last about 12 months anyway in that particular scenario.
Until, what like, did you like have? Did you have moments with him where they're like, you know, he was having like, because like in the entertainment industry, in my humble eyes, it seems that like you have those flamboyant types, and he might not have been so flamboyant, but like of the homosexual nature that likes to then go party pretty hard after work and go, you know, because
it wasn't like that.
He wasn't like that.
He was the opposite of that. It was like, because it was quite reserved. You got to remember, this guy was like in his 50s, and he came out like 2 years before I started working for him. So it was like very kind of like, he was still kind of figuring himself out, you know, like, and I never saw him with anyone as well. So like, it wasn't confronting him, like, you know, he's to the right, you know.
So there was no moments where he was blowing cat up your ass to a silver straw.
No, but that actually reminds me of that time that like I was working in that cryptocurrency for the adult industry.
None of that took place. Well, let's actually we've definitely got to get to that, but let's go to the next stage. So you've done 12 months with this bloke. It's been a great, like, you know, birthing, so to speak, into the industry, like a baptism. What's next?
After that, fuck, man, on a personal side, it was tricky for me because like I'd gotten into this relationship with a girl that I went to school with that I'd known since I was 13. Her mum passed away of cancer. Wow. So like not long after working with Rob, I got a job as a producer, and I was like an in-house producer for a production company in Sydney. I was quite young to be doing that. Like, I was just lucky I kind of landed on my feet through his connection. But at the time, I was like having to manage the stress of looking after her, who was like literally crying on my shoulder every night. And then she was working as a nurse in Wollongong. So, you know, I couldn't see her every day, and she was just a mess. So I had to like quit that job that I kind of worked hard to get to. And then I was like, fuck, this is way more important to be with her. Because I was still quite young. I was like, I'll catch up on that stuff down the track. Yeah. Like, I was like mid-20s at the time. So I put like career and stuff on the back burner, and then like moved out of production world for a couple of years and just kind of like got by. And like, that was actually around the time that we both moved then from Cronulla from Wollongong up to Cronulla.
Yeah.
That's where I met all you guys and started surfing on and stuff, which was like, in hindsight, that's probably one of the best things that's ever happened to me, because like I got to be involved in that community, and like bodyboarding, like, even though it was always there when I was younger, it was kind of there for me through the darker times too. Like, I was literally living in front of the island in that island view.
Yeah, such a good block of apartments.
So good, man. Yeah. And I'd like look out my bedroom window and see the island was good, and then there'd be that window where like people go in after the morning shift or whatever, and the tide's like a little bit weird or whatever, but there'd be like 45 minutes to an hour gaps where there'd be no one around. I'm like, this is sick. So I did nothing but surf, man. I was working at like JB Hi-Fi and like just peddling fucking Mac computers out the door to survive.
That's so good, though.
Living on Red Bull and drinking way too much sugary.
Red Bull's a big staple in JB Hi-Fi.
I know. It was
and
crazy.
And like V's and everything.
Crazy, man. Yeah. But I know your mate, Mikey Murray. From
yes.
Master,
man.
Yeah.
He's still at JB.
Oh, is he?
Well, he's at the Good Guys now, I think, but, you know, in the same corporate banner, you know what I mean? Because they obviously own like a lot of different companies. But, yeah, Mikey is a... The man, eh?
He's
a man.
Yeah,
he knows how to like pep people up in the morning.
Man, he's great.
He's got a real good, humble personality, but he's a great people's person. Yeah, and he's really good at networking and connecting the dots, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, he did a lot of filming for.
Yeah, I know. He was on that boat with Brenda or something.
Yeah. Did film for The Road, did filming for Rome, and a lot of early stuff with like Pensy and Novi and all that, Harry Dixon. So, yeah, small world, eh?
Small world, man.
Yeah. So that was what, from 25 to like 27, 28?
Yeah, pretty much. It was probably from like 25 to 27. And then I reached a point where like.
It was 2 years straight at Island View, sorry?
No, it was like I went between there and this other place in Roker Street, but it was like full of fucking mold, and it was this little one bedroom apartment, and we had like a clothes rack in the living room, and it was just a shit fight.
It was cool.
So stressful.
Yeah.
Like right there where the waves were, but like I just remember that time being so stressful.
Wow.
But like having the island there was awesome because that was my escape.
I was
able to surf and just clean my head.
Just being that close.
For sure. And then things didn't work out in that particular like situation. So then I was like, you know what? Like, I'm going to move up to the coast where my folks are. And there was a job going in Newcastle where I could also like make money in sales and marketing, selling Mac computers in schools and unis and stuff. And I did that for about 6 months and I saved a bit of cash in the back of my mind thinking I want to get back over to LA. Like while I was working with that director, we lived in LA for a stint as well and met like, you know, people that were sort of high up in ad agencies and production companies and stuff. And I was like, I made these awesome connections. I want to give it a crack in production again. How am I going to do it? Who knows? But at least I know some people over there. So I like quit my job and then just bought a camera, a 7D, and then moved to LA and was like living in this hostel in Los Angeles. And my job was like to literally take people out and party in LA. So I was So I was like, I'd literally get given a budget for alcohol to like have drinks at the bar or whatever and rev everyone up and then take them out and show them a good time in LA.
That's sick.
Yeah, good but bad for your health.
I was about to say that's torturous at the same time. Yeah, wow. Yeah.
But heaps fun. Like obviously I was still like 27 and it's kind of like the break that I needed at the time.
Definitely,
And
how long did you sustain that for, that role?
Oh, I don't know how you define sustain because that then went on to a snow season after that, so it probably didn't really... It wasn't the most sort of health conducive path, but it was still it was a good time.
Yeah, buddy, I think you never give those times back. You never give back those times.
I kind of had that in the back of my mind too. I was like, "Fuck it, I'm still young. I know I'm in my 20s, and I know I'm never going to get these years back.
Yeah,
I'm just going to do it now while there's this little opportunity where I can." And I just did that.
And so, where in LA were you partying? Like, where
was it? It was mostly around Venice.
Yeah.
That's where the hostel was. Yeah.
Okay. Sweet.
Venice and like a bit of West Hollywood and stuff. And I bought a car at the time off the ex head of security for Michael Jackson as well.
Really?
Which was pretty funny. Because, like,
it's funny.
I was like, I just want to like buy a car, drive up and down the coast of California, and pretty much knock on doors from these contacts that I made a few years before then.
Yeah.
I just looked, found this shitbox car that was for sale. And then I like met up with this guy and like I jumped in, he picked me up in his shitty car and he was what was his name, like Travis or something. He was telling me about like him and Michael this, him and Michael that, and I was like, fuck this. There's so many people in LA who's like, they always name drop these bigwigs or whatever to try and get ahead.
Yeah.
I was like, he's just talking shit to try and sell me his car. And then anyway, I was like, he's a pretty nice guy, and bought the car off him. And he goes, "Oh, do you want to have a beer back at my place?" I was like, "Yeah, no worries." So I went back to his, and like he had like all these albums with him and the Jackson family. And,
wow! So he was actually
literally his head of security. Yeah.
That's psycho.
Pretty wild, eh?
What the inside info that he would have seen?
I know.
And the possible assassinations or like
was he assassinated? No,
but you know what I mean. Like, yeah. possible, like, you know, crazy fans out there trying to get to him.
Not so
much assassinated, but, you know, like, do weird and derogatory things.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
So that was it was a pretty wild ride. But
and so, like, what was a daily, you know, that's fascinating to me, that lifestyle. Like, what's the daily routine for someone who's, you know, living and breathing partying? And, like, what were the sleeping times?
Man, I was just, like, just living off, like, spirits of alcohol and, like, you know, Subway for breakfast, lunch and dinner, because it was the cheapest, most, like, nutritious thing I could think of, that's what my lifestyle was. And, like, it was a good time. Like, I'd never want to sort of change that period, because it was literally just tapping out of reality for a bit.
Yeah.
And heaps of people do it, you know.
Of course you do, man. Dude.
Heaps of people do it. But that was kind of like,
experience those parts of your life. For sure. Like, it really makes you up at the end. If you don't have those experiences, in my opinion, you can't then have a valid opinion on that sort of situation. Like, you've got to go through those times.
You know,
and enjoy them as, like, much as possible. Know that they're not going to be forever. Just make sure they're not for forever.
I know.
That's all it is.
I know. You've got to be able to tap out. You know? Like, and so anyway, I was like, oh, fuck. After living there, nothing was really happening, probably because I was so distracted and just, like, being an idiot running around LA partying or whatever. I was like, I don't want to come back to Australia, so I'll do another snow season, because I've done a couple in Canada before that. And so I was like, oh, where can I do a snow season? Maybe in France. So I ended up, like, having an interview with this guy who owned a chalet company in France. And then the next day I flew out of LA to London. He picked me up in his van. We drove across France. Then I was running a chalet company for 6 months.
Wow.
So it was wild. I couldn't speak any French.
So how are you getting that across the line? How are you getting
I just bullshitting my way into it, man. I just, like, I fucking don't know why, you know? Like,
so good.
It was funny, though, because, like,
How'd you get through the 6 months or whatever it was without speaking French?
Oh, I learned bits and pieces. Yeah. Like, you learn basic stuff in primary school and a little bit in high school or whatever. And, like, my mum spoke, my grandfather was, like, Italian French. But not that we spoke it at home, but, like, I'd picked up little words when I was a kid.
Sure.
But, like, enough to get by to kind of, like, not, you know, end up in a bad situation or whatever, but I couldn't speak it fluently. No way. I was hopeless.
And so where were you chaleting people to and from?
Well, the chalet was based in the...
Sorry, shuttling. Shuttling people, or you managing...
Yeah, chalets? I was managing the chalet company, but I was also shuttling. So, like, I'd pick the clients up from the airport in Geneva, which is, like, 4.5 hours driveway from where we were based.
Yeah.
And then I'd kind of make sure they're having a good time, set them up in different chalets. And then through the week, I had the cushiest job out of all of them. The poor bastards that were, like, cooking and cleaning the chalets, like the guys I was managing, who all became really good mates, they, like, had the fucking worst job. I could just kind of, like, okay, you guys do your thing, then I'd just go off snowboarding all day. So good.
What resort was this?
This is a place called Saint-Foy, which is near the Tarentaine, like in the French Alps, so near Val d'Isère and Tignes.
Sick.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. So I met this English girl at the time, and her parents actually grew up in Dubai, like really wealthy English family. Her dad was, like, head of an insurance company, and she was a lovely person. Like, we got along quite well, but, you know, it was one of those situations where it's, you know, it's a small place and you end up in a situation where, like, you know, you're kind of pushed into things sometimes because the environment's a small one, and, you know, not in a bad way, but, like, we ended up being together for, like, a year and a half or something.
Mm.
But she had a holiday house in the French countryside. Her parents had a chateau in the French countryside.
Wow.
So they had, like, a Roman well in the backyard and shit. And so we lived there over summer after the season finished, and I was just, like, living in this chateau in the French countryside. And her parents were, like, in Dubai, and they probably fucking hated me because, you know,
they're just drinking all their booze
drinking red wine and eating duck and stuff.
Wow. What French town was this? What was
A place called Auberture, which was, like, in the southwest France, so outside of Bordeaux, probably like an hour and a half of Bordeaux.
Sweet.
Beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, yeah, I love driving through there.
So nice, man. Yeah. Like, sunflower seed, flowers everywhere. Fields, and, like, you're just driving through this, like, painting almost, and your summer is sick.
Yeah, it'd be trippy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It is like an oil painting, isn't it?
So good, yeah. And I was no oil painting. I just don't know how I ended up in that situation.
You could talk the talk, and you walk the walk.
Oh, man, but, like, that was actually, like, an interesting time because I was trying to shoot at the time, or just teach myself how to shoot. I had my little 7D that I bought, little Canon camera. And I thought,
what lenses do you have with that?
Just one 50mm lens or something, like just one or two lenses.
Yeah.
And I thought, fuck it, I'll invest in a water housing and we'll go on holiday somewhere in Europe where there's waves. I know, we'll go to Portugal. So like, Annabelle and I went to Portugal on holidays towards the end of that summer period. It was like late September in Portugal when a west swell started to come in. It was a perfect timing. There happened to be a little possum hill there.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it was actually in Ericeira.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know if I went to Nazaré that trip, but that was awesome that time because like we went there as a couple on holidays, but like the first time I took the camera in the water, I took this photo of a little reef break in town in Ericeira and it landed on the front cover of like Vert magazine.
Really?
I'm like, how the fuck did I just... That was the first time I took my camera in the water ever.
Wow.
So I kind of like, it gave me confidence to like pursue staying behind the camera as a career, I guess.
Yeah.
Not that I did that well in surfing or bodyboarding photography at all, but it just gave me that constant confidence to like really focus on filming and taking photos and just becoming obsessed with the art of that, I guess.
My goodness.
Yeah. And then I met like all these Portuguese crew around that, like Antonio Sereva and Kiko Vargas and Miguel Serrero and a bunch of other guys that have since become like really, really good friends of mine. So like that one moment just changed everything for me. Like that was the one moment that like got me back into production again.
Yeah,
one photo of a reef break in Ericeira. It was fucking special.
That's life-changing.
Yeah, so sick.
So then how did, like, when you took the photo, did you then think to yourself, okay, sweet, I'll, like, you know, throw something out to the magazine, see what happens, and then came back with a cover?
Yeah, fuck, man. I was like, fuck it, who's here? Like, Vert's the only mag or whatever when it were kind of mags. It was just a digital thing, I think, anyway.
Yeah.
And I'd connected with Antonio and, like, we'd since gotten back to Australia and I get this message from Antonio on Facebook and he's like, dude, you wouldn't believe it. You got the front cover of Vert. And I was like, what? Are you fucking kidding me? Like,
that's so sick.
Crazy. Yeah. And it was just like an empty wave. And like, I look at it now and it's like, it's not the best photo in the world. And like they kind of overcooked the grade and stuff. So it's like, it's not an amazing photo to look at and be super proud of. But that moment for me was like really formative.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a cool memory to have. And just all the friendships I made from that point in time. Like it was.
Yeah, well, you're still harboring them now.
Yeah. It's so sick.
So from that moment, this is like late 20s now?
Yeah, this is late. Well, this is. I turned 30 once I got back to Australia. So it was like, 29, 30.
Yeah, sweet. And so then you're past set. You've obviously want to be in production. Mm. You've honed your skills there. You've already gone out and grabbed the gear and taken the bull by the horn, so to speak.
Mm.
What's next from Australia onwards?
I got back to Australia and then we moved back to Cronulla. And I was still started working for a company I was working for before I left, which sold Apple stuff. Yeah. But I started shooting content for them. Mm. So that was a way to kind of like get behind the camera and actually be active doing that. So I started making these little like corporate videos in that space. And then that company ended up folding and I was like, well, fuck, it's now or never. I try and go freelance or I try and look for another full-time job, which is not me. Like, I fucking hate working for the man.
Yeah.
I love pleasing my clients. I love doing a good job and like, I love it when they're stoked with the work that I do, but I fucking hate working full-time.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
It's actually soul-sucking.
It really is. Yeah. Only you've got your own business too, so you get it.
I get it.
Yeah. I mean, you're the same, right? You just want to make your clients super stoked with the work that you do and everything.
And be flexible with your life, though, and have the ability just to be like, okay, well, I'm not working this or I'm doing that or, like, I'm blocking out this week because I want to do X, Y, and Z instead of having to beg and plead through, like, a leave application form or, like, you know, work out some roster or some casual shift swap and you're kind of like, man, like, I get it. Those roles are like required within society, but like if you can try and find your own little niche and work for yourself, it definitely works.
It's
out
the way to go.
In a more like it's balanced lifestyle.
It's fucking hard work. Like you try and explain that to someone, like, you know, you try and hold yourself back from being overbearing about it because I know that's kind of maybe tripped me up in the past with, you know, personal relationships, but like it's you're never not working. Like not like you can't completely turn off, like, but you got to want that. You got to enjoy that, right? Like,
for sure.
that you, on a Sunday, you might have to get on top of invoices that you didn't get a chance to do through the week or whatever, or scheduling. Prep your gear for the next day, scheduling, like get back to an email about someone who's working for you this week and like, fuck, I've got to do this thing. So you're never not off.
Yeah.
And even like, yeah, for me with holidays as well, it's like I'd actually, I like being active, and it's kind of like I like my mind being active and on several things at once. It kind of like is my normal state. And if I'm not doing that, I feel a bit lost.
Yeah.
So like to be constantly thinking about work, but not in a overbearing way on holidays is not a bad thing. I think I'm kind of, I feel like I'm moving forward, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It's all about progression.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you have the weeks where you don't feel like you've done much or you haven't achieved anything, doors haven't been fully open, and then you feel like that's a crappy week, and then all of a sudden next week everything just clicks and all that hard work kind of pays off. And
Yeah, for sure.
Going about all day.
For sure. But yeah, man, so at that time, like I'd finished, I'd like started freelancing, and then like my freelancing jobs, and I still do a bit of corporate stuff for sure because there's plenty of that sort of work out there. But it went from like corporate jobs to then these like little documentaries, and then these documentaries got bigger, and then they went from documentaries to like short form docos to longer form stuff to TV shows to TV commercials and like everything in between kind of thing. So like before the pandemic, like 2019, I was half my work was overseas. So I was doing like a lot of overseas doco work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like traveling around shooting, like I shot this job once in Texas where like the brief was to like go to Marfa in Texas, which is renowned for these Marfa lights, which are famous for these UFO sightings. My part of the brief was to like shoot these UFOs, like capture these fucking UFOs. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Did you get anything at nighttime?
Oh man, there's this platform there which kind of like overlooks the desert, and you see these like little sort of lights in the horizon, but like, you know, it could be the gas coming up out of the ground. Like the plausible explanation is like the gas reacting with like maybe moonlight hitting at a certain angle or whatever. But it does look like these little things kind of dancing on the horizon.
And, yeah.
But like doing quirky jobs like that, and like, we shot this music video for Google as the end client around Asia, like four countries in Asia in 8 days. So we're like land, like do a recce, which is like prep for the job, see if we're going to shoot the next day, jump on a plane that night, and then land, recce, like Jesus. Just crazy shit. And that was just before the pandemic. And then, pandemic hit. And then I was lucky enough to, around that time to land like Fox Sports as one of my main clients. And like they've kind of been like one of my stronger sources of work, I guess, since then. And that really like pushed me into like shooting sports documentaries. I'm trying to, I guess, tie it back to like what I'm doing now with Common Thread. Yeah. But like now, like they come to me if they want to do like high-end sports documentaries, they come to me. So I'm lucky that they see the value in that. But they like, for example, I shoot the major cricket. At the moment, I'm doing like a branded thing with them for McDonald's and Brett Lee's band called Six and Out.
Yeah.
So like we're following them for 2 months, and I'm shooting I'm DPing the main production for that, and like I've done like commercials for like the major campaigns they've done with the AFL teams and NRL teams and whatnot. So like do a lot of sports sort of orientated stuff now, but like documentary focused and some TVC or TV commercials in the mix as well.
Yeah, and you've been also doing a couple of podcasts too.
Potties, yes. I shot like the guys from what are they called again?
See, they were really funny.
Yeah, no, the I can't even remember. I don't even really listen to them, to be honest. Hello Sport, the
Hello Sport guys. Yeah.
But that was a branded thing with Maccas again, where they went up to the Magic Round for the NRL, and we built this big stage and like shot this like live potty experience with like fans there and stuff like that. So not really conventional podcast, but
That's just another
crosses
like,
over a bit.
String to your bow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's all fun. Yeah. It's so much fun. Yeah.
Every week's different.
Yeah. And then we did that wave pool thing as well. Surf. Yeah.
That was great, man.
That was fun.
Yeah, that was amazing. So sick. Yeah.
So good. And, you know, sometimes the goat needs to be sacrificed. But, like, all I can say is that, like, we put a lot of effort into that, and it's so good to see the turnout. And, it's great.
100%.
It's great to see the turnout, and so cool to see that, like, thriving bodyboarding community that, like, there doesn't seem to be like what I've noticed doing this film is like there is obviously no real structure in the sport in Australia. You've got the world tour. Maybe there is. I mean, I'd never follow the Australian tour stuff, but like there's no real like governing body or union or like something that's like binding the sport together.
Especially in Australia.
Especially in Australia now. Yeah. And you see that because like you go to organize something and then someone will swoop in and try and like pull the rug out from underneath you. Or like there's nothing, there's like, it's kind of like the Wild West.
It's a dog eat dog world.
It really is, yeah, man. Yeah. And it's such a shame because like we're all trying, like guys like you, Sam and Sads, like with the Shark Island Challenge, you're trying to like lift the sport up and put your own time and resources into it because purely because you fucking love bodyboarding.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, and that same as you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a real tough one. It's the biggest conundrum in all of bodyboarding, I reckon. It's just like knowing the pathway forward that includes all the different facets of the industry and make sure that everyone gets their slice of the pie, but at the same time, like it's functional and it works. Because right now it just seems that it's not that functional and it seems that it's almost like the high school, you know, lunchyard. And like, you know, there's these little posses.
It's a good analogy, for sure, for sure.
You know, and there's people planning on like doing this sort of attack or there's, you know, people like making sure they get this done on this end. And it's kind of just a bit sinister.
Everyone's got their own opinion and it's like even a different sort of, I know there's a couple of different podcasts out there as well and some of them are quite different and some of them are a little bit naggy towards others and it's just kind of like, fuck guys, like, can't you see that we're our own worst enemy?
For sure. Like,
it's so frustrating.
Man, opinions are like assholes. Everyone has one.
Yeah.
But there's certain people that should, in certain ways, keep their opinion hidden. It's like, goes back to the same saying of like, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it. And I think social media and the ability for people just to have an online platform that has no repercussions, especially physical, in the real world, so to speak, like just take advantage of that and just go to town with, you know, these unbridled emotional outbursts of whatever they think. But they, one, haven't really thought about the whole picture. They're, two, they're only looking through their rose-colored glasses. And three, they don't have the experience or background to be speaking on that sort of level, you know, and that happens
totally,
a lot.
Totally.
But again, everyone's got their own opinion. Everyone's entitled to it. It's just that which ones do you listen to? Which ones do you make the voice? You know?
For sure, for sure. But you can see like the guys like, I don't know, you're close with like Brenda and Coops as well. Like they're doing great work with like the Colchos Bodyboard Club, you know, like they're a prime example of like doing great work within the sport from what I see. I've never belonged to a bodyboarding club. I've never competed except for 2026 when you guys invite me to the Shark Island Challenge. I, as a wild card who's probably going to hurt himself. Right? Yeah, can't serve anyone here as good as anyone else.
Drop the mic.
but seriously though, like I've never been involved in a club, but from the outside looking in, I can see that there are certain clubs that like, you know, they kind of, you know, it feels like that they're in a perpetual motion of like being a club for the sake of a club, but like, and it may be caught up in their own cycle of maybe not moving forward and the culture just being really stagnant. And but then you look at like Coops and Brenda and they're like really making inclusive and they're bringing like young kids and just there's a real positive sort of family feel to it too. Everyone talks about grassroots, but like those guys are really like focusing in on that and that's sick. And also bringing in like some of the old pros. Like I've noticed some of the older pros that used to be like big back in the day that
100%. Alex Bunting being down there is really cool. Liam Tompkins has come to a couple.
And then you've got like the guys who are the best at the moment, like Liam Lucas. Like even he's in that as it's such a sick energy, like to have that spread of people that all want that like positive thing for the sport to come together like that. Like,
for sure, man. And it just shows that like a bodyboard can be used by anyone and everyone.
That's the biggest thing.
I think back to your point before about people kind of being it for their own self-worthy and like self-propagation, I reckon, like propping themselves up to be a head figure or leader within the sport because it's what they've strived for all these years, but it's more a personal goal than a general kind of like industry goal.
And I think
that happens in all walks of life. I'm not trying to say it just happened in bodyboarding, but that's what it seems to me at the moment, yeah, where like self-glory is coming before
like clutching on to like maybe because it's such a small pond, it's like if you're a big fish in that small pond, you want to hold on to that power, you know, like you kind of like you'd probably feel that they wouldn't want to let go of that thing that they have because, like, how do they identify themselves after that?
Exactly, know? Man. It's been their whole life and that's what their life's worth.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a theme that's in common thread, you know, and I've seen it come through a lot of the shorts you've done already with Kingy, Rawlins, Adam Kesbar was a massive one that went, like, you know, it's essentially broke the internet, especially on a bodyboarding scale. Yeah. Like, there seems to be that, you know, the same old narrative and story of people in the bodyboarding industry being disgruntled and unhappy with the way things are going, but all having a jaded opinion on, you know, which way is to move forward. And I wanted to ask you, being the creator of this project, what answer have you seen so far, or like point of view is like the most logical to you moving forward for bodyboarding?
I don't think there's like a one answer solution. I think like what I was talking about, like obviously honing in on that grassroots development and also getting into, I think like if you can convince, if you can convince kids at the age of 10, which is like the most influential age, to ride a bodyboard, you can like that's where the key lies, like, and that might be implementing like a program where you take someone like Liam, for example, like a leading figure who's like still at an influential age to those kids, like they look up to him, he's only in his 20s, but you can put him forward, put him ahead in putting in front of schools and classrooms and convince them that bodyboarding is a really cool thing to do, that will like create change. And we're actually going to try and do that. So like I've connected with the Wave Pool again, so the people from Urban Surf, and I'm going to develop a program where I actually get kids in from Western Sydney and get Liam to coach the kids at the Wave Pool to try and like instigate that sort of momentum in like influencing kids at that like critical age to ride a bodyboard and go into that demographic that like kids on the eastern seaboard close to the coast, Bondi and stuff, they might be already influenced by the fact that like surfing is the cool thing to do, but kids in say Western Sydney that don't have that much access to the ocean, they might see a surfboard as an intimidating thing to start on, but they can begin at a bodyboard and have a hell of a time at it, and then they can take it. They could take it to surfing after that, or they can continue to bodyboard. But it's like, I think it's the best sort of like entry point for them.
Yeah,
you know, and they probably don't have as much of an idea as to like what is cooler because they probably aren't that sort of tapped into the surfing world in the first place anyway.
For sure, and if you give them a great experience from the get-go, and they're seeing the positive outcomes from just one or two sessions, you're already planting the seed and like nurturing it correctly. You know, I think the shortcomings are that a lot of bodyboarders or a lot of kids start off bodyboarding, but then for whatever reason, through maybe like lack of pathways, you know, lack of social acceptances or like, you know, an image based coolness, so to speak, around the sport. And like thirdly, just like the lack of money to see, you know, a sustainable career throughout that sport, being bodyboarding. I think that's the big thing that really shoots us in the foot. And you see a lot of Groms go to surfing.
Yeah.
Because they've got the pathway, they've got the money, they've got the image, they've got the WSL that makes it look all nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, progressive and sustainable, and those, you know, buzzwords you want to use like make every marketing brief the you know, the way forward kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, we've got a long way to go with that.
For sure, like for sure.
We're too core and we shoot each other ourselves in the foot, so to speak.
Yeah, it's so lame though. I mean, like, I get it because, like, you know, we all probably have chips on our shoulders because we have been bullied by surfers at some point in the water, you know, like, and it's still even happening now. Like, I even remember the, what was it? The, I think it was the Kesbar post. Someone like Kobe Abberton commented on it.
Oh, yeah,
it was his one, or was it? I can't remember now, but pretty much wrote up Oogers again. It's like, what are you even doing? And there are muffins that like follow in a fool like that, you know, that kind of repeat him because he's like the alpha male in that particular group. So they just repeat that, and it just like it's a cyclic thing, and it like it gets into the psyches of the kids that are like maybe being teased for riding a boot. Like even this stuff that like I'm sharing these clips on social media, getting heaps of traction. But like the Kesbar clip, for example, half of the comments and likes or whatever are from girls that are just super horny for him.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like that's the number one thing.
Doff of the cat, Kesbar. Kezzy. Yeah.
He actually messaged me. I said to him the other day, it's reached like 2.5 million plays or something. And I said, this is fucking wild. And I said, what's going on? And like, how you find it, whatever. And he just sent me this like screen grab of like all these girls that are trying to like DM him. There's half of the traction is that, but then the other half is like you've got boogers saying, yeah, I can totally relate to this, but then there are still so many kooky surfers that are still like writing us off, you know? So like if you're constantly getting hassled like that, then it's going to affect your psyche.
And 100%.
Like, and, you know, there are guys that like used to boog incredibly well that I'm sure have a chip in their shoulder, not only because of how where they thought maybe the sport could take them, but they still have this underlying, like, I'm a booger, chip in their shoulder thing too, I think.
Oh, for sure.
You know, like, there's got to be some of that stuff going on. We just got to fucking, like, get over it. Like, laugh at the people who are writing yourself. Like Kezzy said, you know, in that clip, is like, it's like, you know, if you do have someone who's writing a booger off, then you clearly know that they're not part of the conversation anyway, because if you're at the solid sessions, like, the boogers have a place, the surfers have a place. The level of surfing's improved drastically in the past like 5-10 years, where they're surfing the slabs that boogers are surfing, they're paddling into them too. Like, hats off. It's fucking incredible to watch. But boogers can still take off a little bit later, you know, and like can ride the barrel a little bit more effectively in certain positions.
And
like,
you're also closer to the shockwave, you're closer to the energy source, you get a different view. You even keep Caddy talk about it. The way you position in the barrel and the viewpoint you get.
Mm.
Bodyboarding to me, and I've been lucky enough to do both and get barreled on both crafts, not that well on a surfboard, but I have on a very rare occasion. It feels nowhere near as good as being on a boog, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you get exactly. The whole kit and caboodle in front of you.
You do.
But on a surfboard, it's kind of like ducking and weaving. I'm sure if you're Parker, I'm sure if you're, you know, fucking Fanning, I'm sure if you're Geordie Smith, whatever, you're going to be able to park yourself deep in that tube and get the same sort of vibe. But that's the top 1% the entry point with the bodyboard is that you can be a lot less skilled individual at the time, harbour those skills and get to where you want to be, but you can enjoy it from the get-go.
It's for sure.
The ultimate ticket in.
For sure. Yeah.
It's so hard to see that isn't recognised, and those kooks on that post continually go and go with it.
Like, but they can go with it because it actually creates traction and kind of bumps it up the list anyway. Yeah. So it's funny. Like, it is funny from that perspective, and like literally wake up to like all these Muppets like saying ridiculous things, and it's like you're fucking wasting your time, but you're also pushing this out there more, this content out there, which is great for the film, you know, and it's kind of interesting for the sport too, because like all walks of life are seeing it, you know. It's like, what is this bodyboarding thing? So
social media is geared so differently there when you feel like the conflict is the thing that fuels a post success. It's quite crazy, man.
So fucking loves it, eh?
It does eat it up. There's divisiveness. I swear to God, I've been looking at posts recently too, and I'm starting to get really good at picking up on bots
and how
they reckon they did like a huge audit, you know, through Instagram and Facebook and X and whatever, and they reckon in between like 60-80% of the users are bots.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and they're putting there as, you know, tools of, I guess, the social division, and they, you know, put a dividing argument in there, get hatred going, piss that person off, change their point of view on all that sort of stuff. So it's, you got to take it all with a grain of salt on social media, but the posts that you do see or the comments that you do see are from legitimate people. You're kind of like, oh, we're a long way to go.
I know, we do. Why, you know, like who's got the,
oh man, it's heavy.
Yeah.
It takes up so much energy.
Like, it sucks you, for sure. It's bad.
So with Common Thread itself, man, like, you know, coming back to the movie, you've gone to a lot of different places and you've kind of, you know, try to tap into a lot of different stories of, you know, key pivotal industry heads within the boog world. Like, What has been some of the hurdles you've had to overcome during these times? Because you've been filming this for like a year and a half now, 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years coming up to, yeah 2 years now pretty much. Like the first 6 months, it was kind of a little bit slow off the mark. We did a couple of little trips, but yeah, sorry, what was the question though?
It was more so just in regards to like over this 2 year period, what is one of the biggest hurdles or set of hurdles you've had to, you've come across?
Hurdles? Probably just finding the time. Like it's like I'd love to be able to jump on every swell and, you know, be there when things go down. Like the Kezzy thing, for example, like I've only really had a chance to follow him down to Victoria once, you know, whereas I would have loved to have gone down there a few times by now.
And he's there every second weekend.
Exactly. Yeah, he's always there. But like he injured himself, you know, a few months ago down there, and that would have been sick to capture. Like he actually captured some of that stuff and someone else did as well, which is good. But like, it's just like, because when you make your documentary, like you've got to, you've got to document over time what's happening and then the story unfolds, and like you just can't be everywhere at once.
Of course.
So that's probably the biggest hurdle, I'd say, for sure.
Yeah, so just spreading your resources out.
Yeah.
Trying to find or pick your moments.
It is, yeah. Pick my moments and like trying to, like it's awesome now that, some really influential people. Because initially my idea was with the Common Thread was to find people that kind of represented different things in bodyboarding, like a bit of a diverse spread of people, and also people that like have their own way of doing it but are good communicators, because like I feel like the sport, there's a communication gap in the sport, and it's one of its like it's one of its downfalls. So like I wanted people who could either talk well or kind of communicate exactly what booging was or who they were or what it was as a lifestyle on camera. So like I started off with like 4 or 5 key people, but now it's like it's kind of like a few people have sort of cotton on to the fact that I'm doing the thing, and I was lucky enough to like go up and shoot with like Kingy a week or two ago, and then Rawlins as well, and then Benny as well, and having those guys like involved in the film now, I think like adds a lot of weight to the doco within the boog realm. Like outside of it, I'm sure it definitely helps, but like within booging, I think it's a big step forward, which is awesome. And like Kingy, actually, I'm just going to say, I'm sure it'd be cool with it, but he's like, why don't me, as in him, Rawlins, and Hardy do a trip for the film? And I was like, well, fuck, if you want to do that, like I'm all in. Let's go ahead and do it. And also, I mentioned this to Ben Player as well, because I met up with him a couple of weeks ago, and he really wants to be a part of that too. So like, haven't spoken to Hardy about it, but the other three guys are pretty keen to be involved. So we're going to do something that's pretty special, I think, to kind of get their insights like over wherever we go to and shoot with them surfing. Insights us to the heyday of the sport as well. So I think people will probably gain a lot from that.
Yeah, the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
The golden ages.
So that'd be cool to really get those perspectives.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And what else have you found about filming the film, you know, the last 2 years that has uncovered something about bodyboarding fit for you that you didn't previously know? Like, has there been anything like of a wild realization moment or kind of
like... there's been like, there's definitely like sort of certain figureheads in the sport that are like more detrimental to the sport than people realize, you know, and like that's a shame, because like there are certain people that you look up to and you think that and like hordes of people look up to certain people, but they don't really see what goes on behind the scenes within the industry and the effect that that person has to people in the industry, like pros and the others that are just trying to make it work as a sport. So like I've had some interactions with people like that, and it's just disappointing. Like I've just been disappointed by the behavior of some people that should really be leading the way and be figureheads and kind of pass on the torch, you know. As I said, I understand it is a small sport and small industry, so like they're trying to kind of like make do with what they've got, but you think that they'd be wiser than they behave, you know, so.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And, you know, from having such a professionally diverse background and working in so many different industries, like him, for example, through Fox Sports, who, you know, cover a wide range of sports, and you would deal with a lot of you know, heavy hitting people in those areas. What has been you know, the most alarming thing that bodyboarding is missing in your eyes? Like, what's the one?
What's it missing? It's just missing. Like, it's missing. sort of just clear communication, like continuity in communication, probably.
Yeah.
And that's where I hope that this film really helps.
Yeah.
You know, like I like it to be a thing that's something that people can kind of refer to and kind of like get a gauge on like what this bodyboarding thing is. You know, like, I hope that's like a, yeah, just opens up the eyes to people that have no idea what the sport is, and to people that might have an idea as to what the sport is, really like educate them around like who the people are, why they do it, why they're so passionate about it, like why the community is so cool and unique. Yeah. Like, I just hope it's that as a resource. But it's, yeah, it's, I think that the sport itself is just missing like probably some sort of like, I mean, I've never belonged to a union or anything like that, but like it's missing some kind of like structure or body or like adults in the room, you know, that's what it's really missing.
Adults in the room.
It is. It yeah, really is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Because I mean, like, boogers are essentially like, a lot of boogers kind of stop booging and ride a surfboard in their 20s. So like, you don't actually get that many. I think Benny said this to me the other day, actually. Benny Player is like, oh, like a lot of people like move on from a certain time, so you actually don't get that sort of follow through of like people going, or maybe it was Kingy, I can't remember, but one of those guys, you don't get that follow through of like adults that are like strong sort of stalwarts in the sport continuing to lead the sport. They kind of move on.
Mm. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't get like that, the almost the elders, so to speak.
Yeah, but you get that in surfing though, right? Like, you surfing do. You've got people who are like in their 60s and 70s are still like really integral to the industry.
You even look at rugby league men.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah, league, true.
Like,
yeah.
When you see a club that has juniors that then put the time into like SG ball, and then they go into, you know, first grade and stuff, reserve grade, like there's that camaraderie and family feel.
It was actually, yeah, it was Rawlins that said that. Now I remember. It was, yeah, Rawlins said that. Fuck, he's an interesting dude, eh? That was like the first, that was the first time that I met him.
Mm.
And, yeah, he had some pretty, pretty cool things to say. Like, he's a bit of a, like, he's probably in a lot of people's eyes the best bodyboarder in the world.
For sure.
You know, like, and he kind of has this quiet approach where he lets his surfing do the talking.
Yeah.
But he has some incredible opinions and really interesting chat on and off camera. But that was one of the things I remember he said, which was like, because he's obviously mates with a lot of the big wig surfers on the Gold Coast and stuff, and he surfs too, and he was talking about the fact that like surfing has that continuity where like surfers surf from young age, continue to do it, and then they're a part of the industry and continue to do so all the way through life, you know,
and they're flourishing.
Yeah,
it's very stagnated here in the boog realm.
Yeah.
It's the most unfortunate thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's also people properly paying their way. Mm. It seems to me that, like, a lot of business dealings from, you know, as yourself, having the small businesses and then bringing those ethics and morals into, say, the boog world, they don't always translate.
Mm.
And I've noticed, like, even, for example, like, certain sponsors will pay for certain footage or clips to be put together or whatever it is, or a trip away, but then others won't, and they still get the same sort of bang for buck out of like that athlete who's promoting them through X, Y, and Z, through Instagram posts or, you know, clips or movie premieres or whatever. Mm. And it just seems that, like, until there's like an overall overarching kind of law and order, so to speak, on like how the boog industry is going to move forward financially, because, like, you know, for example, do you ever watch surfers, how surfers get paid on stuff?
I haven't seen it, no. But I've heard it's really good.
Epic documentary, well, like series of documentaries, and the way they break down how the industry, you know, the inner workings of it, and how certain people get paid through, you know, different avenues. It's that's non-existent in the boog world, because they don't. There's no one really giving two fucks about the people trying to come up and produce content, or the people who are at the top looking down on those people. It's like there's no pyramid to climb, so to speak. It's just like, you know, kill or be killed, like I said before. And that's the biggest thing that I've noticed. There's no consistency there, and there's no pathway. There's just no pathway.
So true.
It's
yeah.
Well, what else do you want to talk about?
Fuck, I don't know. Yeah, I guess like, yeah, I'm aiming to get this doco out by the end of next year. Like originally I was trying to get something out maybe start of next year, but I've got to get more time, especially now that there are more people involved in it.
Yeah.
And I just like, it needs to be as good as it can be, because I'm not going to make another film on bodyboarding after this.
Yeah.
Like I don't, and so I might as well do it properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm aiming to do that. And yeah, it also depends on if I get funding for post-production, because I'd love to be able to like do the post properly. I've funded this whole thing so far, and like making any surfing film, like, it's always going to be expensive because you got to freaking pay for travel and whatnot.
Go to exotic places.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hell of a time too though, right?
Yeah, like, it's a great time, and I'm sure you look back on these memories and be like, they're some of the best times of my life. Mm. But like in a roundabout way, not with exact figures, like how much do you reckon you've dropped on this film or this project alone?
Oh, probably like, I don't know, like 60 grand or something.
That's pretty solid.
Yeah.
That's pretty solid.
Yeah. But it's not that, like it could be worse. I mean, I don't have kids or anything like that. So yeah, I'm lucky that like I can, the money that I have, I'm sort of like, a little bit of money I'm investing back into making this thing. Hopefully I can just pay it off, like whatever it costs in the end. I don't really care if I make money from it or not. I just want to like make a really good thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, if I make my money back, that's sweet. But
and where do you want to premiere this? Like, and how do you want to do it? Is it an online sense? Are you going to do live premieres?
It's funny because like I've got so much fucking content. I said I want to do more and get more content, but like I've got enough to make like a 3-part series.
Wow.
So I could make a series and sell it to a streaming service, which like would be really sick. But a part of me also wants like a premiere so I can like tour the film around the place. So I could do like, you know, a couple of premieres in Sydney or whatever and like go overseas and whatnot. Because you could actually like, you can make money back from premieres.
Yeah.
Especially if you have sponsors on board to like
and good pay merch. For actual,
yeah. Maybe merch, I don't know. I hadn't thought about
merch
that.
Merch it up.
Right? Really? Yeah, oh, merch it up. Yeah, right. Sure. What would you do for, what would be your merch? Would you have like a face of Antonio on a gold chain or something? Yeah, like that?
Definitely. You could do some really good like custom budgie smugglers with Antonio's like just, you know, beautiful Portuguese mo straight down there. That'd be nice.
I've got the best photo for that too.
Do you?
Yeah, I can imagine.
Sick, the amount of time he's been.
Do you know anyone that has a printing business or anything?
Well, these actual images behind us, that's sublimation. So that's I used to work in printing.
Oh, you did too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Only for 2.5 years, but it was a good time.
Okay.
But yeah, that sort of fabric printing is a good...
Sick.
They do all the budgie smuggler.
Yeah, okay.
So the customs I used to load up on the graphic design programs that would come through.
Yeah.
Man, unbelievable.
Sick.
Like, I'm talking some of the Bucks parties and some of the things that would get printed, like John Howard's face on dudes' wangers.
Yeah.
Like, just cruising around in, what's that Marco Polo club in Sydney? The pool party, the Ivy.
Mm.
Yeah. A lot of, like, you know, real nice custom budgies for Ivy pool parties.
Yeah.
And I used to see them all. Yeah. So I've got great ideas for you. If you want to put Antonio's head there. So that's merch.
Yeah.
You can also do hats like that you're wearing. I think they're really popular. The cord ones.
So.
Shirts, you can definitely turn around on the cheap, good quality, and like make bank for it, especially if you made like large quantities.
Yeah.
Let's talk after.
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's talk after. Yeah, let's go big.
Yeah.
Keychains.
Yeah.
Tech decks.
So like speaking, you mentioned PMs. I remember this, like as part of this like docket I'm doing with Brett Lee at the moment. And his Six and Out band. He's actually mates with Anthony Albanese, so we're gonna shoot an interview with Albo over the next couple of weeks. So I thought, like, wouldn't it be cool to like get Albo to say something about bodyboarding on camera?
Oh, definitely.
So I'm gonna try. What would you ask Albo? Like, what would be like? How could we like? What would?
Because you'd want something usable, and he's from the inner west, so he might not have so much experience.
Which is kind of funny, though, right?
It'd be great to get, like, some sort of Bondi quote how the bodyboard is almost, like, the most internationally recognised surf craft or something.
I was going to say, like, something like, you know, he's... like he realizes that like he's now in this thing called politics, but like he really just wanted to be a professional bodyboarder growing up. So he'd rather be like scooping into a 10-foot slab than fucking, you know, on the world stage or whatever he does.
Pack some fucking bombs at Chopes instead of, you know, the French Parliament. That'd be so good, eh? Dude, just do it. That'd go ballistic.
Yeah.
That would skyrocket. I thought Kezzy's one was legit, real.
Oh, man. But, what else could we talk about?
What else with the film? So you could think about like streaming, premiering, tossing that up. You've already mentioned who's pretty much in it. You got like Lily and stuff in there too, right?
Yeah. I actually haven't shot with Lily yet, but she's going to be in it. She'll be in it. Because I've got this entire... Joanna Schenker I filmed with in Portugal at the start of the year. Yeah. He's a legend. She's mate. She's so cool.
She's actually helping us recruit four females for a straight out 4-women final for the Island Challenge.
Really? Yeah, right.
A women's heat.
Cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
Been really good with it.
Yeah, sweet. Okay. Yeah, she's all across like sort of who's the best
for sure.
Female boogers and she's, at the moment.
She's great to work with. Because
just she's good to deal with, man. She's honest, just like switched on and honest. Yeah, she's good.
Beautiful.
Yeah, she's cool. Yeah,
sleek.
Yeah, for sure. Knows how to wrangle a brand or two, eh?
For sure, mate.
Jesus. Yeah. Speaking of people that have like transcended or like made bodyboarding, not that we were speaking about this, but let's talk about people that made bodyboarding work professionally. She's one of the ones that has transcended the sport because 100%. She was able to bring brands on like Volkswagen and now she's been sponsored by like smart cars and like this like a Portuguese beer brand and even though she doesn't drink much and she's just so good at joining the dots with like so like her rise to fame came when she won the world title and that was like the first time any Portuguese surfer across any discipline has won a world title. So like she got heaps of media attention and she was smart with it. Her and Chico, her partner, is her manager. They just both were like, right, let's latch onto this publicity. And they turned like professional bodyboarding into a proper career outside the boogie. They got external sponsors on, like big brands.
She was on a lot of fashion magazine front covers too. Was it QE or like what's the...
Q? I don't know. I don't even know them.
Yeah.
I know the major fashion magazines, but... Yeah, she's been really clever like that, eh?
Say, because you've been filming Common Thread and you've been, you know, speaking to so many different walks of life and bodyboarders alike, what's been the biggest takeaway in regards to female bodyboarding and what's your opinion on how we can improve and what needs to be done next to have the girls flying?
I don't know. Like, speaking to, like, Sophie, for example, who's probably, like...
Sophie Jane?
Yeah, who we were in South Oz together, like... who was it? It was her, Alex, her partner, and Antonio, Steph,
Jay
was there. Tom Healy was with me as well. Tom's been helping me shoot this as well. A shout out to Tom.
Yeah, Tom
has been. Yeah, it's been massive support. So that's been sick.
A newly appointed Californian.
Yeah, that's right. He's loving it down here.
Unbelievable. Oh,
Jesus. You want some stories, you got to speak that.
I'm sure he's getting locked into the Cronulla Vortex.
Oh, Jesus.
It's amazing what the Cronulla Mall looks like in the day compared to what it looks like at night. There's a lot of night crawlers, that come out.
Yeah, for sure. But, so, like, he was there, and then Charlie was there as well. I can't pronounce his last name, Agleman or something, South Coast Burger.
Oh, yeah.
But there was, like, an awesome crew of us down in South Oz for the film, like they were there anyway, but like Antonio and Steph and I and Tom went down to shoot for it as well. And we just had a sick little crew and like got to shoot with Soph, get to know her and did an interview with her and shot some surfing with her as well. And it's cool to get her insights into it. Like she just fucking frostboogie, man. She's like all of us, like absolutely fucking frostboogie.
She's locked in. She's locked in the matrix. Yeah.
And she's a charger, man. Like, yeah. She's surf depot and that sort of thing.
Hats off to anyone who surfs depot.
Oh, for sure. It's not a wave to mess around with.
Nah. Complete floggings out there.
I've been absolutely flogged out there. I've surfed it twice, like once really small and another time where I was in the wrong spot and I just airdropped. And Ackerman said that it looked like my limbs just like got ripped off and exploded off my body, because I just fucking cookishly fell and airdropped and the whole thing just like lifted me up and I just exploded a split of the reins.
Easy mate. Done out there, though.
Oh, mate, it's hard. Yeah. It's hard. Eh? You've got to really push into them.
A lot of variables. Yeah. And it's an open ocean wave. Yeah. It's like a little wind out there. Mm. You've got to be right underneath the ledge.
You do, yeah.
And there's those chipping ones. You can kind of get the rolling ones that bail on the second part of the reef, but then you've got to judge them enough to make sure, like, you're not getting chandeliered on. And there's heaps going on.
There's a lot going on.
Arkin's a very challenging wave.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
it's fucking incredible that way, though. Oh, it is. Every time I go out there and see it, like, we got it really good in March.
Yeah,
and it was that was the best I've seen it. It was fucking like almost. It was like a good 6 hours of it just absolutely cooking,
pumping.
Yeah.
It's a special wave, man.
Yeah. So good.
And what other waves have you got in the film? Like, you've done a lot of different travel. What's the summer location you've ticked off?
So we went to Chopes last year, and that was good. Like, we got really good waves then. Actually, the day that I left, I flew out in the afternoon. Then overnight, it was the day that it flooded. Do you remember there was, like, that crazy flood in Tahiti? And, it flooded the village of Chopes.
And cars got washed out.
Cars got washed out to sea and stuff. Like, rental cars got washed out. The place that we were staying in, there was, like, a foot or two deep of water through it. And I was flying out as it was starting to piss down with rain. So it just went bonkers. I kind of wish I was there for that, though, because it would have been so good to shoot.
Watching stuff getting flushed out.
It would have been so good for the film. But
it's almost like a national disaster.
Oh, it was. It was crazy, man. Yeah. But the waves were cooking, man. Like, I remember, like, sitting in a lineup. There was, like, this really hyped up, lame surf line kind of hype up swell forecast where... I'll just put it on silent. Where... like, it didn't end up coming in as big as they said it was going to. But I got dropped out there, like, pretty early in the morning before any of the surfers hit it. And I was, like, sitting out there in this lineup of, like, 10 to 12-foot perfect chokes with, like, seabirds flying around and, like, pastel skies and the craziest light I've ever seen. Like, the most perfect, perfect waves I've ever seen in my life. It was fucking unbelievable, eh?
Yeah.
So sick.
And no one was out there.
No one was out there. Like, the hands down the best stuff I've ever shot. Like, just unbelievable. It looked like a painting. It was incredible.
Have you got empties in the movie?
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah.
I'm so keen to see that.
Oh, man. Fuck. It was probably the best moment, one of the best moments of my life, eh?
6 day final. Can Pierre get a world title?
I hope he does.
Yeah, me too. I hope he does. Yeah. I don't know if Amir is still in the comp.
I really want to be there to shoot with him, actually. I wanted to be there for the comp, but I couldn't because of, like, work commitments back home. But it would have been sick to be there.
Oh, right now, I would love to be there. I've been actually really into this comp. This has been really well done.
Yeah.
Like, hats off the IBC.
For sure.
It's good.
For sure. Yeah.
Credit where credit's due.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best. It's like the Island Challenge and Fronton are the two best comps for sure.
And you've got like 5 or 6 days of, you know, a lot of competition.
Yeah.
Like in all different faces and shapes that way. But it's pretty sick.
Yeah. I'm just going to say something like speaking of like the comps, like the way you guys like ran the Island comp is just flawless. It was so good. It was so good. Yeah.
I just
know that there were like haters out there that were writing off for like picking a south swell or whatever, and like it was fucking hard work swimming it, and obviously it would have been competing it as well, but like you had to make that decision then because you had the numbers on the ground. There were thousands of people on the point. Like it was so sick. It was so sick to see that. To see so many eyes like walking by, just looking, watching bodyboarding.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I think that's the biggest takeaway from that. And you've highlighted just there in saying that. It's like, it wasn't for the best day of surf. It was for the best moment in competition that could get the most attention on the sport.
Mm.
And that's what our decision at the end was based on. It wasn't like, we would ideally would have loved for like a 6 to 8 foot sow east swell. Like I fully get it. But that day we got, it was a Sunday, it was sunny, there was a big building swell. Yes, it was too south. Yes, you had to pick the eyes out of it. But months after that day, there were no competable days. There was one day, 2 days after that pumped for like 2 hours and that's all we could have got. And to see what the kind of views and energy it harbored, like amongst like the extreme sports world. I think it was a positive and a plus.
That's so sick. Thanks. So what's the go with next year? Just give us a bit of a
So next year, we're looking to, our budget's been increased at this stage, which is great. So we'll be able to work with a more resources, be able to logistically push it forward. We'll be over 2 days, trying to pick the eyes out of the swell and make sure that we get 6 to 8 hours of proper contestable competition. We'll be looking to take the two national winners from both the male and female segments of, from Surfing Australia through our national titles, and they'll get automatic entry into the Island Challenge. So that means that's creating a pathway essentially for people to climb within a national or state national level to then go to an international comp, which we're really stoked on. I think the trials at this current stage for the competition are going to be held in the Urban Surf Wave Pool, because this year we're going to miss nationals and we're going to be able to take two trial winners from the state comps that are going to be held at Urban Surf Wave Pool. So that'll be when New South Wales State's on. Should be around March or April next year. And then those two winners out of the trials, out of the Wave Pool, will then be seeded into the comp. And then the year following, the national winners of 2025 will then be superseded into 2026 comp.
Cool.
So that's kind of one of the biggest improvements in the pathways. And more so just making a festival out of it where, like, you know, on the point, you've got more activations, more space, maybe down at Shelley or at South Cronulla, food trucks, toilets, more, like, you know, infrastructure placed around the comp. And securing the complex again.
Which
we really need to that house. We need to get it again.
It's such a location.
I know. And it's one of the only buildings left on the point that isn't, you know, just a high-rise structure.
Like the front yard there is perfect.
And to get an athlete VIP area. Last year we didn't have that. And we really want to be able to have an area
for
where,
sure,
like,
for sure.
There's ice bars set up. There's possibly a sauna. There's, like, you know, drinks and food and, you know, stuff for people just to be able to, like, you know, chill and make it home. But, yeah, they're probably, like, the main improvements we're looking at.
Sick. Oh, good. Yeah. And when's the waiting period start again?
So 2025, the tides actually look on average 0.2 to 0.3 metres higher, so 20-30 centimetres higher than this year.
Really, right.
Which was great. Cool. I didn't realise how much, you know, only Sads brought up the other day, how much it fluctuates from year to year depending on the celestial calendar.
I didn't realise that.
Neither did I. And I was kind of like, wow.
That's, is it the age of Sagittarius?
Yeah, it must be, you know, for sure. Just bring them all in. Whatever fucking animal it is, you know, I'm happy to have them as long as we get more tides.
The giant shark in the sky.
Yeah, that's it. Just making a big splash.
Yeah.
But so we're probably looking more so for the waiting period to run from April or, kind of more like March, April into, say, like June and August. So, like, I mean, June, July, August. So more kind of, sorry, July, August, because we found, like, this year that autumn and spring have been the best time for swells, and it almost seems that, like, you need that combination of the change of seasons with those high tides that are located in the autumn and spring times for 2025, but with those more kind of easterly swells that we're in winter, we're just getting a lot of those big bombing south swells. And not having opportune wind moments or changes. Like, you know, really ideally what you want to see at the island is solid storm come through, Saui swell generated off New Zealand, doesn't matter south or north island, wherever, just in that vicinity. And you want then a high pressure system to come in behind that with the low located stalling out in the Tasman Sea for pulsing swell, and as the high comes over, brings prevailing offshore winds. And when you get a high come over, usually it's going to push offshore winds for the first day, and then the second day you could get offshore winds again, or offshore to light and bearable. Because of the way the high is moving through. So if those sort of things come to fruition, the spring and the autumn period look the most advantageous.
Really, right?
For that sort of stuff.
Cool.
So we definitely need that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, as you said before, there's been a lot of criticism about the comp being too south. And we know all from, you know, free surfers who enjoy booging out there on a regular basis. It was too south, but there was that time and period to make a decision to better the sport for the years to come, or to then maybe have the same old fucking headspace of like, oh, it's not pumping, we can't run it, we'll have to just wait for next year, which had been 6 years of doing that. It just was...
No, you made the right call for sure. Like that, the Wednesday after was fucking cooking, but it was only cooking for an hour.
Yeah, I know.
You'd never be able to hold a comp. Yeah. You know, like...
And we saw those tides, man. If that those conditions prevailed on the Sunday, we would have had pumping waves all day with those tides.
Yeah.
But then that day was on the Wednesday, and it just wasn't.
It would never have worked.
Never worked.
No.
And that's the hardest thing.
Yeah,
but
it's a hard thing when you're dealing with Mother Nature, though. Eh? It's like...
Yeah.
You just kind of have to roll the dice a bit and make a call, but...
You do, man. You really do. So let's like wrap this with common thread. We're thinking of getting the your plan of getting the movie out
end of next year.
End of next year, so end of 2025.
Yep.
Yep. Perfect. Mm-hmm. And have you made your mind up in regards to streaming or premieres?
It's fucking whatever I get to probably by like April next year, I reckon.
Yep. You'll have more of a clearer.
I might even be able to do it a different way, where I like do some sort of like hybrid like film thing and then also release it as a series, you know, so it's kind of got like a taste for it as a film and get people keen at premieres or whatever, but then like release the series so people like see more of it.
Yeah, that could be cool. Like you could have like a general overview film and then the series,
and then the series goes deeper into certain characters.
And opens it up and that's pretty cool.
Because I guess like it's sort of open-ended as to like what shape it can take, because like I've got full control over it at this stage, so it'd be kind of cool to do something a bit different.
And that's two bites of the cherry too.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. It'd be so fun to premiere. Like, I'd love to do that.
Oh, man, I think we're all deep down inside hoping you premiere.
Yeah.
Because, like, the streaming service, I definitely...
Just the community aspect, man.
That's the biggest thing. When people come together, that's the best thing
about... I really want to do that. Like, that's what the sport's all about.
Yeah, Boog and Surf premieres are like that.
They're
like,
so good.
They're the best.
Yeah.
When Magnitude's Six happened with... Riptide, and they did that huge premiere like up and down the East Coast, little sets of premieres. Just the people that would come to those prems and the vibes and the energy and the turnout, it's just like, can't beat it, man.
Can't beat it.
For and sure. Like, look at, you know, MASH for Noah and Katesy.
Yeah.
Like, they had it down at PK Servo, down at Port Kembla. Mm-hmm. Like, the energy that was in that place.
Is
and
sick?
And I didn't actually get to go. This is just from secondhand accounts. Yeah. But, you know, from being in premieres beforehand and knowing what the vibe is.
Mm.
Like, you know, your premiere, The Chase.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how good was that, man?
Yeah, it was cool.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and everyone's buzzed up. Everyone's loving it. There's good energy there.
Yeah.
No one's sulking.
No, it was great.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Except the chick that I...
Except the maybe the cinema when they got the shits that everyone was pretty rowdy, but that's kind of what you get when you get a boot.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And when I took like questions at the end with yourself up on stage, and I think I called like a chick a dude.
Did you?
Accidentally. Yeah. It was unfortunate because she was, you were probably hyped up on adrenaline, just loving it. Oh, I remember just looking at this female that unfortunately was, female that I thought was a dude at the time. And it was one of the mums of the band members who played. You know, you had like a live band in between.
Was it?
And I remember saying like
that's so funny.
Yeah, and thank you so much for your comments, sir. Like, and she's like, I'm a woman, and I'm just like, just like, fuck. And I had to just steer clear.
That is brutal.
Yeah. You know, you get the good with the bad. Good with the bad. But, man, let's cheers to Common Thread, bro.
Cheers, man. Thanks for having me.
No, and thanks for having me yarn about it, and thanks for doing the film. Because, we need some good watching.
This is all fun, eh? It's good.
Straight, man.
Cool. It was all a pipe dream, watching bodyboarding up on TV.